On Monday, the chief of the Minneapolis police, Medaria Arredondo, did something rare. He testified against a fellow officer, technically a former fellow subordinate officer. Historically, police chiefs have not held their officers accountable for brutality. The trial of Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd raises issues about race, policing, and justice for black people in America. Peter Herbert is a retired judge who served on London's Metropolitan Police Authority. He's also part of a group of international legal experts looking at the problem of police violence against Americans of African descent. Peter Herbert joins us once again from Nairobi, where he's been following the trial of Derek Chauvin. So you live, Peter Herbert, in the UK and in Kenya. How are cases of excessive or lethal force by police handled there compared with here in the US? I mean, do you see any useful comparisons?
I think there are. I mean, the thread in this case is racism. And sadly, whether it's in the United Kingdom or France or the US or even Canada, there is a disproportionate number of killings of particularly black men by those police forces. There is generally an uphill task to have anybody convicted, let alone sometimes charged. And there has been to date, I think, only one, if ever, any prosecution of any police officer successfully in the United Kingdom for murder or manslaughter, whether the victim be African, Caribbean or white.
I mean, how has that been addressed over time in the UK?
Well, there's been various commissions. There's been reports on unlawful killings by police and prison staff. And there has been, I think they run at between 50 and 60 a year. So a lot less than you have clearly in the United States. But I think the main difference is we do not generally have a police force that is armed. And they have to, if there is a situation that calls on firearms, they have to call in an early response unit. And there's automatically a suspension of any police officer who is found to have shot anybody or been involved in a potential unlawful killing.
The people of Minneapolis, especially Northside Minneapolis, they know painfully well the levels of crime where they live. In an ideal world, what do you think this trial should represent in terms of establishing a baseline of trust so that people, blacks and people of color especially, can also see police as helping them deal fairly with crime that impacts them?
Ironically, and I haven't seen the studies, but actually, generally speaking, if a person of African or Hispanic descent is in trouble in the United States, they'll call the police. They might fear the consequences of calling the police, but generally speaking, they, like anybody else, that is the first port of call, 911. And having met some of the police officers of African descent in Atlanta and elsewhere, some of them have very high standards of professionalism. The problem is that police culture in the United States has become increasingly militaristic. It has responded with a disproportionate use of force. And sadly, the racism which has lain at its core since, in a sense, since emancipation is still there. And my perception of white and sometimes, sadly, black police officers is they are so much in fear, or purportedly in fear, of African Americans and Hispanic Americans that they shoot before they think, or they impose the lethal use of force before they even de-escalate. So I think it will be a long time before trust and confidence is ever gained within the minority communities in the U.S. with the way they're policed.
What can this trial do to shift that narrative? What will you be watching for in the coming weeks?
Well, I think it would help if there's a conviction of second-degree murder. I mean, if it's an acquittal of anything or of anything less, then it will seriously cause serious damage to public confidence, which is already very low. I would look to see it becoming the norm for fellow police officers, particular chief officers, if they have the lawful right to sack an officer for serious misconduct, they need to get in the witness box and testify and do so vigorously. And the fact that what we've seen in all over Europe and many other parts of the world is the police closing ranks and there's a veil of silence. That has to be lifted. And the notion that these are somehow a few bad apples is nonsense. The disproportionate level of racial profiling and the huge numbers of individuals that are restrained using unreasonable force in the US can only be explained by racism and power being endemic within many US police forces.
I'm speaking with retired Judge Peter Herbert, who's part of a group of international legal experts looking at the problem of police violence against Americans of African descent. We're talking about the trial of Derek Chauvin. Judge Herbert, we're speaking to you in Nairobi, Kenya. Is this trial something people there are paying attention to? And are you in conversation with friends or colleagues about what's going on?
Yes, I think like most parts of the continent, Kenya has its serious problems with police violence and extrajudicial killings. And therefore, the brutal murder of George Floyd was graphically illustrated for all to see on video. There were demonstrations outside the US embassy, and also there were similar protests by people from Kibera, one of the largest slums in Africa, about the way they were treated. And sadly, they were met with batons and by tear gas. And it was only because there were demonstrations outside the US embassy, which were visible to the international community, that they were dealt with differently.
What impact do you think a televised trial has on justice and just people's faith that justice is being done?
Well, I think it does help. I have watched, as with many years before, the trial of O.J. Simpson, Michael Jackson, and now we have some cases on appeal which are televised in the UK. But I think open and transparent justice is singularly important for any democracy. And warts and all, you need to see it. And therefore, it means that people don't second guess where the truth lies and what the verdict should have been. And also one of the things that you will know from the Rodney King case, I mean, these cases led to such a disappointment in the fact that justice was not done. And having it seen doesn't mean to say that it's done. So you have to have, in a sense, what is visible for all the world to see be commensurate with the actual outcome. And if there is a disconnect, then obviously society as a whole will pay the price for that.
People outside the US, what stake do you think they have in this trial?
I think everybody has a stake in seeing justice done. The world is a very small place these days because of the internet and YouTube. And America is generally, or was before Donald Trump, held in high regard generally in some of its application of human rights. That obviously, if the justice system is seen to fail George Floyd and others like him, then, for instance, the Chinese government will be well within its rights to say to the United States, well, why are you talking us about the persecution of Uyghurs when the persecution of your own minorities for hundreds of years has been so appallingly dreadful? So I think there are all sorts of lessons, good, bad, and ugly, for the United States, and it is our sincere hope that justice is done and seen to be done.
Judge Peter Herbert, part of a group of international legal experts looking at the problem of police violence against Americans of African descent. He's been speaking to us from Nairobi, sharing his views on the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. Thank you very much, Judge Herbert.
Thank you very much indeed.
Just ahead, 10 Iranian officials are indicted for the downing of an international passenger plane. Some families of the victims on board call this a far cry from justice. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 16 months after a tragic plane crash near Tehran, today 10 Iranian officials have been indicted for what happened. All 176 people on board the Ukraine International Airlines flight were killed. Iran's military shot down that plane just days after Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed in an attack orchestrated by the U.S. Joining me now is Hamed Esmalian. He's a spokesperson for the Association of Families of Flight PS752 Victims. Esmalian lost his wife and daughter on that flight. This news out of Iran, Hamed, that 10 officials are being indicted. Is justice being served?
Oh, not at all. You know, Marco, it's 16 months past, and we have no names. We have no details of the fight. None of the families and none of the lawyers of the families had an access to the fight. This is just a show from Iranian regime to show to the world that the justice is served, but no, it's not really what we want to see, and it's not really what we expected for the criminals of this crime.
What did you expect, and what else would you like to see done?
This crime has an international aspect here. 85 Canadians were on board, 17 Swedish, 4 Brits on board. So the first step is the truth. We have a strong belief that this plane was not shot down by human error. There are every reasons that it can be intentional. If that's the case, I think that was a criminal act and it can go to the International Court of Justice. This is our destination, the right place to go, I think.
So how can the international community help families get more answers from the Iranian government? And what role should the U.S. play in getting the kind of investigation, the kind of justice that you and other families are really hoping for?
We think that we are swimming against the currents now. When everybody talks about talks with Iran, about JCPOA, they try to put the human rights files aside. 176 people got murdered by this regime. I think the international community should be united on this for the victims of terrorism and stand for them. And we have to set PS752 as an example for the world that nobody does such a crime again.
It's been just over a year since this terrible tragedy. Hamed, I'm wondering if you can tell us about your wife and daughter. And today, when you think about them, what memories do you hold on to?
Marco, I and lots of family members, we have dedicated our lives to PS752 to find the truth for the victims and for ourselves and then see justice one day. It's hard to say. In the last 15, 16 months, I was more focused on writing letters, rallies, negotiations with the officials, meetings with other family members. So my wife and my daughter, I remember them every day. There's a graveyard in Richmond Hill near Toronto that I go there every day, but I don't have the courage to talk to them that where we are and what I have done. I think the day that we see the justice is served is the right day to go to my wife, Parisan, my daughter, Rira, and to other passengers of flight PS752 and tell them, okay, we have justice now. I think that day probably can be a big victory for the families.
Doing the work with the Association of Families of Flight PS752 Victims, what has that meant for you? Has sharing this tragedy in some way with others helped all of you?
I think they are the only people who understand my pain. They are the only people who really know what I'm going through. There are 10 fathers like me that they lost their wives and their children. It's great that now I have new family members. We are very close to each other. We see each other every day through the digital meetings, and that gives us courage to go forward and not give up. We are fighters, and we are going to fight till the end of this fight.
Hamed Esmailian is a spokesperson for the Association of Families of Flight PS752 Victims, speaking with us about the Iranian government's most recent response to this disaster. Hamed, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco. Thank you.
It may not be an election top of mind for you, but it could impact you enormously. In Greenland today, the polls are open for a snap parliamentary election that many see as a referendum on a proposed mining project. Greenland is a territory within Denmark of 56,000 people, and they're in the middle of a global struggle over rare earth metals, elements that are used in things like cell phones and computers. Joining me to discuss this is Javier Arnaut. He's an economist at the University of Greenland. So tensions have been running high in Greenland due to this mining project for some time, I gather. Government ministers have even gotten death threats. What exactly is going on there?
There's been a controversy in the south of Greenland because there's an Australian company that is developing a mine that intends to extract uranium and rare earth metals. And the dilemma here is that Greenland sees this as an economic opportunity. This development can be also at the expense of the environment.
Right. So kind of a classic dilemma. What would the environmental impact of the project be? What are opponents worried about?
Yes, because the mine is very close to a town called Narsaq in the south of Greenland. And there is a concern that if the uranium mine starts producing, it will pollute the nearby area. As you know, the Arctic natural environment is very, very vulnerable.
I mean, as you say, though, Javier, Australia is involved in the mining project. China is also involved. Is this small territory of Greenland caught in the middle of geopolitical giants? And when push comes to shove, does it matter what the outcome of today's vote is?
It is, definitely. Definitely. Greenland is now in a very geopolitical dilemma in whether to allow Australian and Chinese investment in their country at the expense of weakening other important links with Denmark and the United States. China has an important monopoly in rare earth minerals. They account around more than 50% of the total production. It is a very crucial point in geopolitics right now.
How concerned are you that investor countries will just continue to seek out those rare earth metals in Greenland?
This type of development eventually will happen because global warming is untapping different mineral deposits in Greenland. So if it doesn't happen now, this type of extractive development, maybe will happen in a few years.
You're saying because of ice melt, those minerals, those rare earth metals are just going to make themselves appear and will be easy
exactly,
to access?
Exactly. So wow. It is something that perhaps is inevitable. And the question right now is whether Greenland wants to capitalize at the moment or perhaps wait until they strengthen their institutions and the public sphere becomes more aware of the necessity of promoting this type of industry.
Javier, would you say that the average person in Greenland has been following this issue pretty closely? And is there a feeling there that the world is watching?
They are. I'm a teacher. I'm a lecturer here at the university, and I've been talking with my students, and they're very nervous and tense at the moment because they would like to know what's going to be the development in the next few years. And there are two visions of the development. So, yes, we have very, very interesting times, and students and, well, the local population are very looking forward to know the result tonight.
Javier Arnaut is an economist at the University of Greenland. He joined us from Nuuk, Greenland, and was speaking with us about a mining project in the territory that is the focus of a national vote today. Thank you very much, Javier.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Reporters couldn't visit, and now the U.S. military has closed its secret building at Guantanamo Bay that housed high-value prisoners.
It was the iconic representation of the idea of Guantanamo as being outside the law.
President Biden wants to shut down the entire detention facility, but can he? That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. LGBTQ people in the United Kingdom have been working for years to combat the rise in transphobia across the region. Despite some progress, the UK has become an increasingly unsafe and hostile place for transgender people. A new study shows that hostility reaches into the workplace. In the UK, two-thirds of transgender people say they keep their identity secret in the office, a sharp increase just over the past few years. From London, The World's Orla Barry reports on what's driving this.
Ashley Talbot remembers how she used to hide her identity at work. Talbot, a transgender woman, was working in tech support in Manchester in England. Most of her colleagues were male, she says.
And it was a very laddish culture. You know, all of the work's dues were just let's go and get smashed on Stella kind of thing. And I also was acutely aware because of some of the stuff that I'd witnessed there. I'd witnessed homophobia towards another one of my colleagues. And I knew perfectly well that if I was to come out and start living my truth and being a trans woman, it wouldn't go well.
So Talbot says she didn't come out to her colleagues. Instead, she gave her notice and left the job. Even today, almost a decade later, she still doesn't want to name the company. A recruiting firm recently conducted a survey and found that trans people are feeling less safe at work in the UK. Two-thirds of respondents said they hide who they really are from work colleagues. But 5 years ago, only half said the same thing. Talbot says she's not surprised because the debate around transgender rights, she says, has gotten really ugly in Britain.
These things are being splashed across the front page so often, and really it is astonishingly often given that the trans community is such a small percentage of the population. And yet for a period, every single Sunday, there was something in one of the big newspapers that was just overtly transphobic or misleading.
Back in 2018, the UK government decided to review the Gender Recognition Act. The law governs how trans people can get their gender identity legally recognised. The trans community wanted the process simplified, saying the guidelines were demeaning and invasive. But debate around proposed changes to the Act often descended into arguments about whether transgender women should have access to female-only spaces like bathrooms. These discussions are happening in other countries too, like the US. But Ashley Talbot says some of the loudest voices here in Britain are different.
It's exactly the same rhetoric. as in, you know, trans people are a threat, they're a danger to kids, etc. On one side of the Atlantic, you've got hardcore evangelical Republican Christians saying exactly the same thing as the people on the other side of the pond who are calling themselves progressive feminists.
Some of these feminists are well-known commentators, appearing in newspapers that span the political spectrum. They argue that sex is not a social construct, that people should not be able to change their gender on a birth certificate without a medical diagnosis, or that trans women be able to access female-only spaces. One of the groups Talbot names as being particularly vocal on the issue is called Fair Play for Women UK. It's an advocacy group that says it's working to protect the rights of women. I reached out to the director, Nicola Williams, for a comment, but she didn't respond to my request. Here she is talking to the BBC.
Biological sex doesn't change. People can identify with whichever sex they like, but fundamentally, someone's biological sex doesn't change. That matters to women because males are a sexual and physical risk to women. There are 500,000 women sexually abused every year by males.
Williams argues that women's refuges and female prisons should also only be accessible to those born female. Reform of the Gender Recognition Act was eventually shelved, but debates around the rights of trans people have continued. Sophie Lewis is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania's Centre for Research on Gender, Sexuality and Women. She says the political climate in the UK and in the US over the last few years has made things more difficult for the trans community, and the pandemic isn't helping.
So that combination of nativist, reactionary politics around Brexit and Trump, and then the conditions of a pandemic would, I think, contribute. I would expect to see people being more afraid to be out as trans.
Lewis says the law forced some trans people to move back in with their families and effectively back into the closet. She adds that feminists have been criticising the transgender community for a long time, and it's not just a British thing. Radical feminists expressed transphobic views back in the 70s during the second wave feminist movement in the US. In Britain more recently, high-profile writers like J.K. Rowling have also added fuel to the fire. The Harry Potter author published a lengthy essay linking her own experience of sexual assault with her concern over transgender access to women-only spaces. Sophie Lewis says the author's words were devastating for many of her transgender fans.
J.K. Rowling coming out in that particular way was extremely heartbreaking for trans kids, for trans adults who paradoxically saw themselves and saw a kind of secret sort of germ of their own queerness and transness in the stories of Harry Potter. This was an incredibly sad sense of betrayal.
Stonewall, a well-known LGBTQ charity, says it's also not surprised that trans people are finding things more difficult today than just a few years ago. Emma Cosman, head of workplace consultancy with the charity, says they had similar results when they examined attitudes at work before the pandemic.
So our research found that 1 in 8 trans people had been physically attacked by customers or colleagues in just the last year, just for being themselves at work. And 1 in 5 trans people wouldn't report transphobic bullying in the workplace.
Cosman says there are no good excuses for employers to not make an office more inclusive for trans workers. And the British government has a role to play too, she says. There's currently a petition calling for conversion therapy to be banned in Britain. Doing this would send a signal, Cosman says, that the rights of all LGBTQ people matter. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The US military has shut down a once-secret building at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Guards transferred high-value prisoners to other parts of the facility. Among those moved, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the September 11th terrorist attacks. President Biden says he wants to shut down the Guantanamo Bay detention camp entirely. That would require congressional approval. Karen Greenberg is the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. She focuses on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties at Fordham University School of Law. Karen, why were the prisoners moved from Camp 7?
They were moved because of an ongoing deteriorating situation within the camp. For years now, they've been talking about problems in terms of the sanitary conditions and even safety provisions.
I mean, the military has never acknowledged the existence of Camp 7. No journalist has ever been allowed to visit it. What do we know about it? Is it just problems with sanitary conditions?
No. What we know about Cant 7 is that it was the icon of the idea of Guantanamo as being outside the law. And this is where they had the high-value detainees, so-called, that had originally been at the CIA black sites that had been tortured there, that were moved to Guantanamo. It's also where abusive interrogations reportedly took place. But it's been its own version of a black site at Guantanamo. So in terms of that symbolism of moving it, it is, you know, symbolically a step away from the black site that was within our purview.
Besides Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, do we know how many and who else are among the prisoners who were moved over the weekend?
We know something. It's interesting that in who they said was moved, they said, well, it was around, some reports said around 12, around 14. Since the very beginning of Guantanamo, when Department of Defense officials and others are asked how many prisoners are at Guantanamo, they've always said about a number, which is one of the more frustrating aspects of reporting on Guantanamo. It's not hard to count people, but we are assuming that 12 high-value detainees, including not just Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but the other four detainees that are alleged to be co-conspirators in the 9/11 attacks are there, and others who were either tortured and were there or who will at some point be facing military commissions.
Do you think this is a sign that as 9/11 slips into the past, people like KSM are somehow able to be merged into the rest of the Gitmo population?
I don't know what that really means, because, you know, being merged into the rest of the Guantanamo population, when you say KSM, because these are people who are supposedly going to be tried. However, their trials have been delayed and delayed and delayed year after year. And the rest of the Guantanamo population, for the most part, is not going to be charged or tried, but is going to be reevaluated term after term by the Periodic Review Board to see if they are no longer pose a threat. So in a way, they're not really being merged in terms of the description of them, the way they're treated, the category that they're in. They are very much a separate category, and any closure of Guantanamo would pertain to them in a different way than it would pertain to those who are the forever prisoners who can, in theory, be transferred to other countries under whatever conditions.
Right. So President Biden has revived the Obama-era goal of closing the detention camp at Guantanamo. Remind us why it didn't happen under President Obama.
Politics got ahead of him. It moved very quickly. He did not anticipate the kind of backlash he would get. I think there were lessons learned. Don't give a timeline. Give yourself some room. What Biden has indicated is that by the end of his term, he would like to close Guantanamo.
Can you imagine Khalid Sheikh Mohammed transferred to a U.S. prison and a U.S. court someday?
Of course. I've always been able to imagine it. It's absolutely ridiculous that we haven't tried the perpetrators of 9/11. It is a disservice to the American people, the direct victims of 9/11, and the country at large.
So you focused on Guantanamo for a long time, Karen. What do you think the lessons are of using a detention camp on an overseas U.S. naval base in this way?
The biggest lesson is once you go there, it's really hard to stop the momentum and to break it. Once you break the law by torturing people, it makes it almost impossible to adjudicate them in a way that really rises to the standard of military prosecutions, that we have to trust our law, and that when we don't trust our laws and trust our belief in our laws, that it undermines the system overall. So in other words, the lesson is this was a mistake that was made and that we've been paying for it ever since.
Karen Greenberg at Fordham University School of Law is the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
A few years ago, banning plastic straws was the hot environmental trend. Hollywood got in on the act.
Most of us suck every day. Suck, suck, suck.
Suck.
500 million plastic straws are used in this country every single day.
And many end up in the ocean, polluting water and killing sea life.
We started sucking on stainless steel straws, glass straws, bamboo straws. Beijing is on board with the movement, too. The Chinese government banned disposable plastic in restaurants at the beginning of this year. But that move attracted criticism from a very vocal group. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai has a story about the backlash from fans of a massively popular beverage.
When you're drinking bubble tea, one thing you really can't do without is a straw. How else can you suck up those chewy balls of tapioca? Most restaurants and cafes in China were using conventional polypropylene straws before the ban, and they made the switch to paper straws en masse. But customers were having none of it. Xiao Cao is sitting with his girlfriend at this trendy tea shop in Shanghai, drinking his daily cup of bubble tea. Paper straws are no good, he says. If you use them for too long, they get all soggy. It affects the taste. Bubble tea chains quickly offered up another straw option, made from PLA, a plant-based bioplastic. But the complaints from bubble tea drinkers had already started a national conversation around straws. In this Chinese TikTok video, a woman compares different types, complaining about each one. Glass straws are out, she says. They could break in your mouth. Plus, they're not sharp enough to puncture the seal. Neither can metal. Rubber has a weird aftertaste, she says. In all, she tries 6 different straws. In the past decade, China's begun tackling its waste problem, banning waste imports from the U.S. and other Western countries, and in 2019, piloting waste sorting schemes to separate food waste from other waste. But landfills and incinerators are still overused. Jiang Miao is the founder of an NGO focused on waste reduction. She says the ban on disposable plastics has created a loophole. Now sales of PLA bioplastic are way up. Yes, PLA is technically compostable under certain conditions, she says. But most people can't tell it apart from conventional plastic, and they just end up in the trash together. The problem isn't solved. Recycling is lacking infrastructure, she says. The government should support the development of a formal recycling system, she says, to better handle the plastic waste. Manufacturers have a role to play, too. I visited a straw factory in Yiwu, a city near Shanghai, to see how the ban has impacted their business. On the factory floor, machines spew out colorful straws. They're collected and bundled into boxes by workers. But instead of the conventional plastic ones that used to be produced here, now they are mostly making paper and PLA straws instead. I talk with a worker, Yunlei, while he mans 3 machines at once. Reams of red and white paper ribbons pass through the machine. They're dipped in glue and wrapped around a metal dowel like a candy cane, then are cut into straw-length pieces. Yun waits till the straws pile up, then packs them into boxes. He says he handles 300,000 straws a day. My tour guide at the factory is Lo Zhongping, who's known in these parts as the king of straws. Turns out, after the plastic straw ban, his business is doing better than ever. Lo was a member of the study group that recommended the government ban disposable plastic straws. There's always going to be a market for straws, he says, but we have to push for change. During the pandemic last year, Lo replaced his machines with new ones to make paper and PLA straws. He made another switch. He dropped his export business for the most part and focused on the China market instead. Production is now up, and because the cost of these new materials is higher than conventional plastic, he can charge more too. Lo leads me to the showroom, which is full of reusable straws made of metal, heavy-duty plastic, bamboo, wood, glass, even some made from wheat stems. It's not that plastic straws themselves are bad, Lo says, just the way we use them. Still, his research team is trying different materials to wean people off their disposable habits. This straw made from corn and pumpkin starch is colorful, he says, and edible too. They taste like raw pasta and last an hour in cold drinks, he says, as he chews on one. Best of all, after you finish your drink, you can boil them up into spaghetti. There's still one problem. These straws will melt in a cup of hot bubble tea. Environmentalist Jiang Miao says there are no easy solutions. There's more attention being paid to plastic waste, she says. But people are so used to the cheapness and convenience of plastic, it's going to be hard to change their habits. The Chinese government is pushing on, promising upcoming bans on plastic bags and one-use plastic in hotels in the next few years. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Start your day with a quick hit of stories from around the world. You can sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, and begin the day globally informed. Just head to theworld.org/newsletters. Coming up, new music from the grandfather's tradition. We're talking Afrobeat here. Plus, spiders on Mars. That's up next. You're with The World. When I say spiders from Mars, you may very well think of this.
Ziggy played guitar.
David Bowie's Imaginary Spiders from Mars. For the past 20 years, though, scientists have been examining a different kind of spider on the red planet, not actual spiders. They're looking at dark blobs that branch into a spider-like pattern in the Martian soil. It is weird.
They're like nothing seen on Earth, so they must be formed by a process that's not Earth-like.
Lauren McCown is a planetary scientist at Open University in England. She says researchers think these spider patterns form when the Martian seasons change.
The ice descends onto the surface in winter, kind of like how we get snow and ice here in winter. And in spring then, as temperatures heat up, the sunlight actually gets trapped at the base of the ice.
And from there, pressure builds up. The ice cracks and the planet's surface splits into these spider-like troughs. They're not very deep, but they can spread really far, like the size of 11 football fields. But because none of this stuff happens on Earth, it's been tough to prove the seasonal ice theory. Until now. McYoun and a team of researchers were able to recreate a Martian environment in a lab using dry ice. McYoun says this information could be essential in the event that humans end up there.
If we ever go to Mars, I mean, these processes, quite frankly, could be a hazard. You know, if you have this plume going off right beside you, you know, you're going to want to know if this is likely to happen if you plan to land in this location.
Humans, of course, are not likely to land on Mars for some years to come, but when they do, it'd be nice to have a smooth surface to touch down on, a surface that is not buckling with spidery ice troughs. Nigerian musicians are definitely having a moment. Burna Boy won a Grammy for Best Global Music Album. Wizkid got one for Best Music Video for the track he produced with Beyoncé. And now the founding father of Afrobeat himself, the late Fela Kuti, has been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Today, it's Fela's children and grandchildren who carry on his musical legacy. The World's Halima Gikandi has a story.
Free your mind, 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 and set your soul free.
Free Your Mind is the opening track on Made Kuti's debut album, Forward. It was released in February. Made is the grandson of the legendary Nigerian performer Fela Kuti and the son of famous musician Femi Kuti.
I first discovered my love for listening and watching music by watching my dad play. He used to play four times a week at the Shrine, and he used to play so much that I used to wake up for school the following day and still catch him on stage. So I was always overwhelmed by how passionate he was about music.
Forward is actually part two of a double album Made created with his father, Femi. They each worked separately on their own albums, then put them together under the title Legacy Plus. It's an ode to the legacy of Afrobeat. On Made's album, he sings, plays the trumpet, and the drums, and the guitar. In fact, he plays all of the instruments on the album, and he tells me what inspired the opening track.
If you want change to happen, you really do have to know how to bring it about. So Free Your Mind is just about using your mind to its fullest potential.
Which means using it for social change. Speaking to social woes is at the heart of the Afrobeat genre that was popularized by Made's grandfather. Fela's music was deeply political, controversial, and more often than not, critical of Nigeria's government.
So everybody that knows him will know that he was a very concerned citizen, and in many ways an activist. He fought for human rights, he fought for, you know, understanding culture, he fought for his community.
That legacy has followed Made throughout his life. He grew up playing in his father's band, and now that he's become a musician in his own right, he's had to search for his own voice, his own sound in the genre.
So I did my sound to take from the things I was passionate about, which is Afrobeat, but I like rock a lot, I like reggae, I like classical music. I studied classical music for 4 years. I still teach myself jazz. So I wanted all of this to reflect in the music.
At 25, Made represents a new generation of Nigerians and Nigerian musicians, many of whom live in the diaspora spread across the globe. But they're still dealing with the same problems that Fela's generation did: corruption, unemployment, and poor infrastructure, Made says.
Nothing works. Healthcare doesn't work. Education doesn't work properly. Light doesn't work. There was a time I was seeing the plumber in our house more often than I was seeing my brother.
Made lives just outside of Lagos, which erupted in massive protests last year. People were fed up with abuses by a special anti-robbery police squad called SARS. The officers had a reputation for corruption, extortion, and violence towards civilians. Police brutality is something Made explores in this track called Your Enemy. Police officer, Sasa Mama, they are innocent. Made actually wrote this song a year and a half before the protests broke out over police brutality. This has been a problem for a long time, he tells me, and that got him thinking about what causes it.
So the policeman is really just trying to make a living. He's underpaid. He has many children. He can't afford school fees. He, like us, can't deal with power cuts all the time. He has to buy generators. He has to feed his family. He has a wife. Like everybody else, they will find a means to survival by any means necessary. And if it means they have to extort innocent civilians, they will do that. The civilians, they suffer, and police said they suffer, then who they cause they suffer, then.
The real enemy, Made concludes, is the system, and the problem with the system is corruption. Made closes his debut album on an optimistic note in a track called We Are Strong.
Come, tell me what it is you believe. Do you not see there are some things that we cannot do if we don't do together?
It's a message of unity for Nigeria, a diverse country with hundreds of different languages and ethnic groups. They'll come to unite, Made sings, to gather their rights for their people. Just the sort of line that's easy to imagine coming from Made's grandfather. For the world, I'm Halima Kikandi in Nairobi. One by one by one, they come to
unite, they come to unite, together they'll rise together. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PRX.